Welcome back, one and all, to the Damage Report. One last show, and then we're done. We can go to the weekend, it'll be fun, we can relax, and nothing terrible will happen. Anyway, I'm John Derola. Joining me today to close out the week is Brett Ehrlich of Happy Half Hour fame.
And I own glasses, so you should get used to it.
There is something much smarter looking about you. Don't open your mouth and spoil it.
Brett can read.
Okay, it's a little bit spoiled. So look, we're gonna talk about a lot today. We have AOC grilling the head of the DHS. Very interesting and emotional questioning there that we're gonna talk about. We've got a new presidential candidate, and Sarah Kleiner's gonna be joining us once again to break down his finances, both what he's going to be taking in and also what he's been giving out throughout his career. And we're gonna be analyzing that and try to figure out what effect he's going to have on the primary. Also on the primary, did you know that over the past few months, for one candidate in particular, the percentage of the primary voters who say they will never vote for this candidate has shot up pretty precipitously. We're gonna reveal who that is a little bit later on. We've got updates on Ilhan Omar and now ESPN. Should they talk about politics? We'll be debating that with Rick Strom, TDR sports correspondent, to close out the show.
Why did you say it so laughingly?
Because he's not technically the sports correspondent, even though he is.
Yeah, but
he doesn't
is.
Like it.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't like that you call him. You just tap him. You go.
Exactly. He likes coming on whenever possible to talk about sports and politics. Does not like being called the sports correspondent.
Oh.
So that's what he is. Can we get the Chyron ready, whether he likes it or not, and put it in a really bold font and cover up half the screen?
Fair enough.
Okay, let's do that. And there's another story that I really hope that we have time to talk about. I'm not even going to tease it specifically in case we can't. But
you are.
I'm just saying vague.
But you are right now.
Well, I mean, that was very vague. I'm still going to be a little bit vague. The things that are not racist, a Republican state lawmaker has included something in there that's just mind blowing. Maybe we'll have time. We'll see. But I'm undercutting my chance of having that time by going on, so I won't. Let's turn now to DHS and AOC for very important commentary there. Yesterday, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was talking with acting DHS Secretary Kevin McAleenan. And
McAleenan.
McAleenan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's just acting. We don't have to respect it. Anyway, McAleenan, about the ProPublica report on that ridiculous, insane, violent, and racist Facebook group that had thousands and thousands and thousands of members of CBP, Border Patrol, ICE, DHS, and all of that. And I want to break down some of her questions to him and his answers. Here is the first.
Mr. Secretary, are you aware of the ProPublica report indicating that there were about 10,000 potential current and former CBP officers in a violently racist and sexist Facebook group?
I am aware of the ProPublica article, yes.
Did you see any of the posts in the report?
I did.
Did you see the posts mocking migrant children's deaths?
I did.
Did you see the posts planning physical harm to myself and Congresswoman Escobar?
Yes, and I directed an investigation within minutes of reading the article.
Did you see the images of officers circulating photoshopped images of my violent rape?
Yes, I did.
Are those officers on the job today and responsible for the safety of migrant women and children?
So there's an aggressive investigation on this issue mm-hmm. proceeding. You've heard the chief of the Border Patrol, the most senior female official in law enforcement across the entire country, say that these posts do not meet our standards of conduct mm-hmm. and they will be followed up aggressively.
But officers...
We've already put individuals on administrative duties. I don't know which ones correspond okay. with which posts, and we've issued cease and desist orders to dozens and more.
Okay, so that's sort of purposefully sort of like, hey, here's some water, here's some mud, let's swirl it up there. Yeah, many of them are still on the job. That's what I got out of it.
Because we're doing an aggressive investigation as to who posted these things. Right now, the clues are their names on Facebook connected mm-hmm. to profiles with their faces on Facebook.
Okay, you're being
smug.
And we
just have to connect the dots at that
point. No, you're being smug. The only way that's gonna help is that if those are their actual names.
Right.
They are, though.
And they are their actual names, all the way up to the woman that was referenced when they said we have a high-ranking female member whose posts are on this site.
Yeah, I don't know the name of the individual who posted, and lots of these things are absolutely horrendous, but in particular, the violent rape of Representative Ocasio-Cortez. Who is that person? Are they currently working? That would be a significant one. Maybe the people commented on it, shared it, liked it. Maybe track down those people first. That would be a good one. There's a few. Look, anyone who's involved in the group needs to be investigated, obviously. But the people who were sharing and commenting on and just loving the horrendous racism and violence and all of that. I would start with that. That would be, for me, an aggressive investigation.
Right. And well, I guess in his defense, there's 10,000.
Yes, that's
posts.
True. That will take a little bit of time.
In his defense, he allowed it to get so big before finding it mm-hmm. that upon finding it, mm-hmm. It really is kind of a pain in the buns to figure out.
Yeah.
And then also his defense are on administrative duties. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean they're actually like answering phones as opposed to out in the field?
It sounds like they have more time to make memes and post them on Facebook.
Right.
Is
we
what
decided,
it sounds like to me.
The problem is that, you know, they really got in trouble by being on a computer. So we're going to literally put them on a computer all day.
Yeah, exactly. So we have one more video. We're going to throw it in just a second. I know that this is asking too much. And it wouldn't happen, and not just under a Republican president. This is the way you act when you're being called before Congress. But like when she's listing all these things, and especially once she says, "Did you see the pictures photoshopped of my violent rape?" And he says, "I did." Express something.
I thought he did.
You did? He did? You did?
He was answering officially, but he was like, "I didn't. I didn't find that like." He had the opportunity to say, mm-hmm. I did, and they were horrible.
That's what I mean.
But he did kind of, he just said, I did.
Yeah, I'm not saying that there wasn't anything
he
in
didn't
it.
Go like,
there wasn't
I
a twist
did,
on
know.
It. He wasn't like, oh, I did.
Oh, I saw
I get
them.
That. But I'm saying like, I did, and you know, as the acting head of DHS who has to manage these people, I just want to say it was absolutely reprehensible. It should never come to that, not for you, not for any other member of Congress whatsoever.
Right, but when, I think the bigger position is he already
seemed defensive.
He denied a culture of dehumanization.
Well, we're going to get to that actually right now. And that's where the defensiveness comes up even more, as you'll see.
Do you think that the policy of child separation could have contributed to a dehumanizing culture within CBP that contributes and kind of spills over into other areas of conduct?
We do not have a dehumanizing culture at CBP.
Okay.
This is an agency that rescues 4,000 people a year, that's mm-hmm. absolutely committed to the well-being of everyone that they interact with.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't believe there's a dehumanizing culture.
And Mr. Secretary, so you don't think that having 10,000 officers in a violent, racist group sharing rape memes of members of Congress points to any concern of a dehumanized culture?
Congresswoman, those posts are unacceptable. They're being investigated, but I don't think it's fair to apply them to the entire organization or that even the members of that group believed or supported those posts.
Mr. Secretary, just one last thing. How did 10,000 members join this group, including I believe the head of CBP? I'll double check, including the CBP chief. How were they in this Facebook group without anybody knowing, without anyone in leadership knowing?
Again, this is the subject of an ongoing investigation.
I don't know, but I'm going to have to assume that they did not join it without leadership knowing.
Well,
I mean, as
her
she
question,
pointed out,
her
CBP
question
had,
is, her question is, how did leadership get in this group without leadership knowing?
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes you misclick.
Right, you misclick and then write comments yeah. on it.
Yeah, so look, that was, in my view, a very defensive response. And I get it, he's the head of DHS. He has to defend DHS and the sub departments that are under it. But it definitely, like, it makes me worried, not just about a dehumanizing culture in a CBP or DHS. It makes me worry about dehumanized all of our culture. That this is such a big thing, not just in this group, but all over the place. But you know, we're focusing on this. When he says, so I have a question for you. When he says, I don't think it's fair to apply this to the entire organization, what percentage of the organization needs to be a part of it before you think it's fair?
Isn't it already 1 in 7? Like, isn't 10,000 like 1 in 7 employees?
I think it's much more than
one
in
like 1 in 5.
I think it might be more than that, but I'm not sure. Let's say 1 in 5, 1 in 7, something like that. I think that's fair.
I would say this. I would say the job that they were tasked with carrying out in child separations is itself dehumanizing. I think if I'm the head of it, I say I am always concerned about a culture of dehumanization, and mm-hmm. I should, and it is my cause to fight against it. Yeah. And I think that a responsible department head would say, I fight that when it comes to policies like child separation, when it comes to how we allocate funds to keep people who are in these detention centers in sanitary and safe environments. And when it comes to groups like these on Facebook that run wild, we need to stop them and hold literally everyone else accountable. At that point, if you're holding them accountable, everyone that made these kinds of statements back them up, And commented just as snarkily on them, your priority also needs to, well, then you face the problem of what do I do when I have to fire one in five people to work for me.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Or you know, put them on administrative leave. How much administrative work is there to do?
Administrative duties.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Just duties, not even leave. So two quick updates. One, after all of that, and you know, that's so important because again, I mean, we're worried about violence against these individuals, these members of Congress. And in that particular case, when members of the like in service to the US government are posting memes about them being assaulted and them being raped literally by the president. I would be worried about that. And so she had her chance to talk to him and he gave responses or whatever. She said, at its core, abuses at the border are not about whether some CBP officers are good or bad people. It's about how our border policies are gravely dehumanizing and strip all involved of human decency. Once you order people to violate others' rights, a culture can quickly devolve. And I think that that's exactly right. She was asked a sort of follow-up question this morning by an unidentified reporter who said, is that what you're advocating for? Open the borders to anyone who wants to come. And she replied, no, I think we're advocating for a humane border. And he, Trump, can't conceive of a border where we don't cage children, rip them from their parents. And to him, a lack of torture equals an open border, I think to him and to most of the people on Fox News. He literally cannot think of an immigration system where we don't hurt innocent people. So I think that's where he's coming from. And I think that that's right. She was attacked constantly for saying that DHS should be destroyed. And you know, we go back to the system that we had just 17 years before ago, before there was DHS. She was attacked relentlessly for that. And I mean, look how it's being used and how much we found out just in the week since then.
When their argument is, when the founders of this country created the Department of Homeland Security in 2001, it's like, no, that's new.
No.
You're picking and choosing what you think the fundamental aspects of this country are, and you can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and
well, I would say that my arguments for what I consider to be fundamental promises of this country are better and more virtuous than theirs.
And remember, when they attack her for saying that basically one of the newest components of the US government should be devolved and those subcategories put back to what they were doing, but with more oversight. Just remember that every Republican primary debate is a race to see who can name the most departments they want to destroy. Education and the EPA and all this stuff that are just, they're a little bit older. Yeah. DHS.
Going back to old ways is inherently a conservative position.
Exactly. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. We come back, lots more to cover.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
At a time when many Americans are thinking, couldn't we have a few less Democratic candidates for president? We now actually have one more with billionaire Tom Steyer joining the race recently. And joining us now to break down his history both of political giving and now his need for your money in return, federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Sarah Kleiner, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks, John.
So for a while, I thought that we had been sort of catching up on all of the candidates and these little breakdowns of their finances, but it looks like we have a little bit more work ahead of us. And so I want to ask you sort of an intro question, because with this individual, he had said in January that he was not going to be running, and in just a few months he changed his mind. So what changed?
So he became disillusioned with the candidates who were running, the multiple, many, many candidates who are running, over 20, and decided they weren't delivering the message that he felt like we need at this point. So he decided to enter the race. And he did so very recently, too recently though, for us to know much about his fundraising, although we do know he has plenty of money on his own.
Definitely, he's an actual billionaire. And so before we get into you know, what he's going to be doing to raise money, let's talk about his history of political giving. How big have his like presence as a donor, his wife Catherine, how much have they given? And also, if you could tell us a little bit about some of the groups and individual candidates that he's supported in the past.
Sure. So in the 2018 cycle, where we had the midterm races, Tom Steyer and his wife Catherine were the third most generous donors. They gave $70.8 million leading up to the midterms. They were behind the Adelsons and Michael Bloomberg, only those two groups. And he has bankrolled Democratic campaigns to the tune of $237 million over the past three election cycles. So that's going back to about 2013, 2014. He has a lot of money, and he gives a lot of money. He has Next Gen America, a nonprofit, a super PAC. Also, he has Need to Impeach organization. And he basically has been bankrolling these organizations and going around the country for quite a while now, trying to get in front of potential donors and voters to familiarize them with his name.
So you did a great job pointing out the groups and the individuals. There's also the cause, and that is impeachment. He's spent quite a bit of money pushing for that in the last year or so, right?
Yes, he has been, he has slick Facebook ads, digital ads, television ads, and he has been going, he actually went on a town hall tour. This was long before he decided to run, but it was, you know, the thinking was that he's building a list, a massive list, and at some point he'll convert that list and that staff into an operation to run for president. He actually came through near where I live, near Washington, D.C. He went to Largo, Maryland, and he stopped off in Arlington, Virginia last year, and I was able to meet him. I went to both of his events, and he's, you know, patting backs and shaking hands and laughing at jokes and, you know, really trying to relate to people, not trying to project an image of a stodgy billionaire. He was trying to project this image of a person who is for the people, of the people. So it was interesting to see.
I too try to project that image, actually, but I still come across as a stodgy billionaire. So let's turn now to his campaign. So look, many of the people who run for politics ever, and in this primary, they're wealthy to one degree or another. But with Tom Steyer, how would you rate his ability to fund his own campaign on a scale of 1 to 10?
11.
Thought he might.
Yeah, he's so if you look at the personal financial disclosure statements that each of the candidates has filed, you can see a number of millionaires or potential millionaires. You know, they have to report their assets and liabilities in ranges. So we don't know exactly how much someone is worth, but we have a pretty good idea it's between X and Y. So yeah, there are many millionaires running in this race. Mm-hmm. But there is only one other potential billionaire, and that's Donald Trump. Yeah. So Steyer comes out on top of that list just from the outset. He is behind in terms of having time on the campaign trail, but he has the money to fund his own campaign. Forbes has rated or has estimated his net worth at $1.7 billion, and you know he has said he's willing to spend $100 million of his own dollars, of his own money, on his race, which is quite a bit of money.
It's one less thing to worry about, I guess. But the interesting thing is, because of how this Democratic primary is structured, even though he does not need people's money, he does desperately need their donations to qualify for the debate stage, right? So, do we know anything about how he's messaging around that, how successful he's been so far in generating individual donations?
So I'm not sure so far, but we are going to find out relatively quickly. He has a lot of work to do to get mass appeal. Now, he has a big email list of people who signed on to his Need to Impeach messaging tour. But are those people going to convert to donors? And are they going to help him pass that threshold to get onto the debate stage? We'll find out very soon. But that's something we have to wait and see. Also, since he decided to jump into the race so late, we just had a big deadline for quarterly filing for quarterly campaign fundraising reports. And we won't know until the third quarter reports are due where he stands with other candidates in terms of his small dollar donations.
And finally, he probably does not need donations from corporate CEOs and other super PACs and things like that. But do we have any indication yet of what his strategy will be, what money he will reject?
No indication yet, but that is something that his competitors, the other people running for office, are making an issue of. And Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have said they're not going to take corporate money. Many other candidates have said the same thing. It's become an issue in this election. But we'll have to wait and see what Tom Steyer himself decides to do. He obviously doesn't need it, but we'll see if that's something that he winds up accepting or rejecting.
Well, Sarah, as always, we appreciate you joining us. I know that we still have a few other candidates to get to, so hopefully we'll have you back on in a little bit and break down some more of them.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, John.
We're going to take a quick break. We come back. Ilhan Omar is warmly greeted and in her return home, and we're going to show you a video of that after this. There you have Representative Ilhan Omar returning home. And just to be clear, in case any MAGA heads are watching this, that's her home. It's America. And a lot of her very excited constituents there greeting her after a tumultuous week. I think it's fair to call it that. It was more than 100 people greeting her at the baggage claim area, the Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport. And because of those 100 people, it took her even longer to get her bag than usual. Totally kidding. But that was nice to cap off the week. Starting back on Sunday when she was attacked horribly by the president, and then it just seemed to get worse each day, culminating with that insane rally. That was a nice moment, I think.
Yeah, it's nice to see videos where people are nice people. Mm-hmm. And there is a enthusiastic group of folks with no hate demonstrably saying nice things to someone who has been painted so hatefully by the president.
Yeah, hearing the chant "Welcome home," and then you're like, "Waiting, what terrible thing?" Oh, that's it. That's they're just welcoming someone home. That's good. I like
that chant. Minnesota. So I'm happy. I'm happy to see stuff like that. I think it's very important. I think everyone needs to share this video widely to prove that there are folks who don't suck.
Exactly. And she addressed some of those folks who don't suck. Talking about how she's holding up after all this.
Have your back.
Okay, I love that. That was pretty great. Mm-hmm. And so that's all good. We're gonna keep that in the spirit of happy half hour as a positive news item. I'm just gonna briefly mention that Donald Trump did attack her, that what we just showed you, that gathering on Twitter. I'm not gonna show you the tweets, but I will say that his criticism was that it was a staged gathering, which apparently MoveOn.org, I think, helped to get some people together. The use of the label stage, though, is a little bit ridiculous considering that they're actually enthusiastic fans. And this is Donald Trump, who at his initial first rally ever when he was running had literally paid actors to be there. And but I will give this to him. This is kind of more artificial than his rallies where he just randomly goes to a stadium and finds tens of thousands of his fans waiting for him.
Right, it's way more staged than things when he's on a stage.
Literally on a stage.
They have a person whose job it is to get a stage another person who sets up a stage. And it's so frustrating. I just need to get this out there. I was watching Fox News this morning and referencing the rally where Trump originally had the folks that were chanting, send her back. And they were so proud of the president for coming out against that chant. They made him out to be the hero in that situation, as though them sending, chanting, send her back, did just materialized out of the blue and wasn't the result of Trump's fierce tweeting about it.
Exactly. Yeah, that he hadn't been ranting about Ilhan Omar as well as other members of the squad, that he didn't sit back for 13 seconds doing literally nothing to stop it. I think Stephen Colbert said it was like a lizard basking in the heat of a racist sun. He was just absorbing their hate waves. And then once it started to die off on its own, then he starts attacking her once again. Only brings up that he interrupted it and tried to stop it and didn't like it when he was asked by a reporter and then lied about his participation. There's no cover to say that he deserves any credit there.
And it's very important.
But that's state media.
It is very important for people to realize that he is not clarifying his statements and refining his message to a point where it is palatable. That's the typical like arc of a gaffe where they say something, they try to change it, and then they eventually get to a place where they're okay defending it and people move on. No, he is telling different lies to different people to get those different lies to stick with those different people. So he wants to he wanted people to chant send her back. That's why he tweeted, send her back.
Yeah.
Send them back.
Yeah, now not just her.
And now he's trying to say, well, it's I have a problem with Ilhan Omar's un-Americanism. They changed the statement from the original send her back to something else, which is if you don't like it, you can leave. And it wasn't about the other three. They're already trying to convince you that that's the position. But they're not trying to convince the rally goers that that's their position. They still need and want the rally goers and the Fox News people that Fox News, the viewers that are being covered for, they're covering for Trump. They need them to still believe the original statement. And they need you to believe the lie. But we can't let that happen. And we need to call out the original statement.
Yeah, and the only reason that Trump and his defenders on Fox News now, and by the way, also people like the New York Times, who in their articles would often say he didn't actually try to stop it, but their headlines were all he distances himself, he denounces it, all that, totally fake. The only reason we can go through this charade of pretending that the very next Trump rally isn't gonna have the exact same chant is because nothing matters. It's the least bold prediction in the world, but you can write it down right now. At that next rally, they're going to chant. He is gonna make a joke. Oh, we're gonna get in trouble for this. All those people, fake news, they're gonna hate this. And then at the next rally, he's gonna smile when they do it. And at the next one, he's gonna lead the chant. And eventually, they're gonna be selling t-shirts, send her back. That's the arc that we're on. Everybody knows it. Some people are just temporarily lying about it.
And Omar's position is we're gonna continue to be a nightmare for the president because his policies are a nightmare for us. And that's the pivot that everyone needs. That's the opportunity people need to take with this. The Trump's trying to put you in a like a searchlight spotlight. Yeah. And you need to use it as though you are in the spotlight on the stage to put on to message people to what they will actually respond to, which is we need to make America better.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, we're gonna touch base with the Democratic primary after this. We're still extremely early in this primary process. And so, you know, polls are gonna go up, they're gonna go down. They're interesting, but they're not destiny necessarily. But one thing you'd probably like to avoid is having an increasing percentage of the voting population say that they will never vote for you under any circumstances. And for one candidate over the past few months, that number has risen quite a bit. And for one other candidate, it's fallen quite a bit. Let's break down some numbers now. I saw this originally by Dave Weigel on Twitter. It's a CNN UNH poll, and it shows that for Joe Biden, between February 2019 and July, the number of voters who say that they will never vote for him under any circumstances has risen from just 3% to 14%. Now that stands out from all of the other candidates. You can see, for instance, Bernie Sanders there. He was at 8%, that stayed steady for a few months, and then it dropped a couple of points down to 6%. So for most of them, the vast majority, we're not gonna show you all the numbers, but it was at like 1 or 2%, it's still at 1 or 2%. But for Joe Biden, it has shot up quite a bit.
To me, this, I don't think there are Like, this is a weird poll. Mm-hmm. That's why.
Why is that?
It's just like, who will you not vote for? It seems to be in line with who had the people that had the person had the best performance in her debate. The number of folks who said that they will not vote for her went down.
And the person, you're talking about Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren, and the person who had the best the worst performance in the first debate, more people are like, oh, I would never vote for him. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more a reflection of the performance in the debate and fallout after that than it is a representation of the true number of people who would, quote, never vote for Biden.
Yeah, so I think the reason I think it's worth focusing on is with any poll, you never know what is motivating a person to respond in the way that they are. And you never know for sure how much they're thinking about it or how durable it'll actually be. Like if somebody says, I'm definitely gonna vote for X candidate, what percentage of them definitely do? You'd assume pretty high, but not necessarily. And that's why at least here where they're saying under any circumstances, they're trying to get people to really think about it and be pretty sure. And that is a big change, especially when, like, you know, Beto O'Rourke, like he's done really badly since February, right? But for him, the numbers, and I don't have them right here, the numbers for him didn't significantly shoot up, even though he's been doing really badly and he'd previously had a higher approval.
But that
rating
wasn't the takeaway from the debate. Mm-hmm. Like the narrative takeaway from the narrative in terms of how the election is going, the takeaway from that debate was Kamala Harris owns Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden is slow. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, hey, Beto O'Rourke still whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think, and I also believe, and it seems to bear out over multiple polls over time, that folks know their answer in a poll, and they know this is a political poll, and they know, and many of them know they have a political opinion, and they want to get it through polls. Mm-hmm. So they will get that opinion through a poll, no matter what the poll is. And I think what that poll does in particular is try to scare them away, as you said, by saying under any circumstances, but that just scared a certain number away versus others who were like, no, he did terribly in this debate and he needs to, and people need to know about it right now, and this is my opportunity.
Okay. Just briefly, I wanted to update you on what the voters think in terms of approval of these various candidates. As of right now, so far, Bernie Sanders still has the highest favorable rating at 72%. And you can see there Joe Biden's just a couple of points behind. It starts to drop off a little bit faster there. But of course, the percentage who have no opinion of those individuals also rises as you go down. It's pretty much only Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden where I don't expect that to really change that much, the percentage who don't already know quite a bit about these candidates. And it's interesting that for both of those sort of baked in attitudes are generally positive. Like they have the exact same unfavorable rating amongst voters and Democrats and independents who lean Democratic.
Yeah, so what do you think of this? What does that mean to you, seeing this favorability poll that puts the you know, the those, there's really,
I mean, I would
cut off after Harris, maybe?
I guess I would be happy. I mean, I'd be happy if I was Bernie or Joe based on that, but I would also be happy if I was one of those next tier, knowing that 30 or 45% of the electorate still hasn't made up their mind. We're gonna have a lot of debates and a lot of time for it to change.
Right, there are no people who, besides de Blasio, amazing, whose unfavorability breaks 20%. Mm-hmm. So that's amazing to me.
Come on, de Blasio.
De Blasio, give me back my soda pop.
Yeah, he's still on the debate stage.
Because he just doesn't seem like the kind of person that folks really would know about given his polling numbers.
I mean, if you're—
But they know the
considering
the
city,
but like
that's
Klobuchar
national.
Has a giant right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so do the people who you know, all across the board have similar like unfavorability, 20%, 17 or so percent are like, yeah, I don't like that person.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so just briefly, I do wanna give a little bit of a preview of the next debates, which I'm gonna be covering actually in Detroit, both for the main show doing live commentary on the nights of the debate. I'll also be uploading videos that I'll be filming in Detroit as well for the Damage Report on YouTube and Facebook. But last night was the ceremonied up choosing of the two nights. And here's what we ended up with after an hour. So night one is going to be Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg, and then you start to go down in the polling. Well, I think Buttigieg and O'Rourke are basically the same. Klobuchar, Williamson, Delaney, Hickenlooper, Ryan, and Bullock. So you have a bunch of the centrists all together. As many people have noted, out of the two nights, you do have one that's all white. So that's interesting.
It was amazing. And Marianne Williamson counts as like two white people.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I would probably put Hickenlooper on that list as well.
She got whiter when she went, "Hey, girlfriend."
Okay, so but what we have is Sanders and Warren on the debate stage together, as well as Buttigieg and O'Rourke. O'Rourke, I don't know what he could do at this point, but he's going to try to get his name back into the conversation. Buttigieg would love to have a good moment against either Sanders or Warren. So I'm going to read the names on the second night, and then I want to get an idea which do you think is going to be the night to watch. So on the night two, we have Biden again with Harris. Biden probably gulped when he saw that, but you also have Booker and Castro, Yang, Inslee, Gabbard, Gillibrand, de Blasio, and Michael Bennett.
Yang's in the center, for what it's worth. He's in the center bank of
yeah, he's a tier two candidate in their choosing thing.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah, sure.
He's got
a big time.
He's got a big following, and he's raised a good amount of money. He has a lot of donors and everything. I think that that night, unless I don't think that Harris is going to be like, you know what, I'm going to twist that knife. I don't think that she's going to do that. That would make it exciting. But you do have, it's still 10 people. There's still going to be moments, and a lot of people are going to have seen that Harris moment, and they're going to think, you know what? If Biden can't defend himself, I'm going to be the one to attack this time. And so maybe it'll be Castro, or maybe it'll be Yang. He certainly wants to talk this time. Maybe it'll be Gabbard. You know, we don't know.
Yeah, I'm more interested to see night two, even though.
Oh, really? Night two?
Yeah, that's the one
with Biden and
whatnot. Yeah, that seems like it'll be more entertaining.
Okay, so my I guess the big question in terms of what can most shake up the runnings, the polls, and everything, will Biden have prepared for this one?
Yes. So I mean,
because he was not ready last time.
Hopefully, for his sake, he prepares. Like I don't care, but if he should prepare more than he did last time. But him not having prepared much for the previous debate doesn't necessarily mean a lot if he redeems himself, because if American politics is anything, it's an expectations game. He has successfully lowered his own expectations. Mm-hmm. And if he exceeds them, he will be congratulated for it, even if it's only slightly better than last time.
That's true. I wonder, is the Biden campaign readying some sort of attack on Kamala Harris's prosecutorial past? Like, would he risk that to try to sort of get back for what happened last time?
He just needs to talk about policy, positive policy.
He doesn't want to. That's not his campaign.
And change them.
And also have different policies and then communicate them. Maybe I'd vote for him at that point. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. We come back. TDR sports correspondent Ricky Strom is going to be joining us to break down ESPN and politics after this. I know what you're probably thinking. Sports and politics have never mixed before, but maybe we're entering into a time where for the first time ever, they should. And joining us now to break down how ESPN could be putting their foot in the water, or maybe not. Sports correspondent, Ricky Strom.
I love that title. Thanks, man.
Thank you for joining us. Brett's here as well. So what's going on with ESPN today?
So Dan Le Batard is the son of Cuban immigrants, and he took offense to what Donald Trump said in his rally in Greenville, correct? When he told Ilhan Omar, when the crowd chanted for her to be sent back to Somalia. So he reacted on ESPN's airwaves, and here's part of what he said.
There's a racial division in this country that's being instigated by the president, and we here at ESPN haven't had the stomach for that fight, because Jamel did some things on Twitter and you saw what happened after that. And then here, all of a sudden, nobody talks politics on anything unless we can use one of these sports figures as a meat shield in the most cowardly possible way to discuss these subjects. Because this isn't about politics, it's about race. What you're seeing happening around here is about race, and it's been turned into politics. And we only talk about it around here when Steve Kerr Popovich says something. Muhammad Ali was fighting for this stuff in the 60s. The Bill Russell and Jim Brown are really old. He's going to go to the grave without having seen change. He's going to go to the grave with Colin Kaepernick still out of the league. It is antithetical to what we should be. And if you're not calling it abhorrent, obviously racist, dangerous rhetoric, you're complicit.
Okay, so I loved every part of that. Now, I've literally never watched the show before, but I know that when I come in every morning, you're listening to it.
Every morning.
Do they talk about politics from time to time?
They have, but the main reason why they've skewed away from it is because ESPN's new president, Jimmy Pitaro, has essentially said, we are not going to talk politics at all, at all. Now, it's hypocritical because if we remember when the Philadelphia Flyers, for example, took down Kate Smith's statue because of the song that she had and she sang a while ago had racial undertones, Will Kane, by the way, full disclosure, super gung-ho conservative, thinks climate change is a hoax, thinks fossil fuel companies should be dictating laws. Watch it on Bill Maher. He got torn to shreds by Soledad O'Brien. And then a few other parts. Essentially, he worked at the Blaze as well. There's the home run. So he commented on this like crazy. You know what happened? Nothing. When he called Antonio Brown, who forced his way out of Pittsburgh, as we all know as, well, sorry, as we all know as sports fans.
I know what Pittsburgh is.
Where?
That way.
Correct.
Just ask Skip and Asher, who work here and are from there. Yeah.
Exactly. When Antonio Brown forced his way out to go to Oakland, Will Kane called him essentially a suicide bomber and called him a terrorist. You know what happened? Nothing. So this whole we're going to stick to sports thing, it just doesn't work with them. It just simply doesn't work.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right that they do shoehorn. I mean, you still have people there that want to talk politics because we have to talk politics, because otherwise people who are using politics as a web issue, as a wedge issue, do not get any pushback. And so they end up using clips of, you know, Steve Kerr, who's the coach of the Golden State Warriors, and then Greg Popovich, who's the coach of the San Antonio Spurs, and then anyone else. Later in that same clip, he references Russell Wilson if he says something on Instagram. And so they have to play it, and then they can talk about it. And it is utterly ridiculous. And the thing is, everybody who's doing it at the network and needs to talk about this knows how ridiculous it is. And
that's the root to it.
And it's Levitard who points it out because he's the son of Cuban refugees. And shouldn't we take it more seriously because he actually is speaking from firsthand experience, even though he doesn't need to have that firsthand experience to acknowledge exactly what's going on? But he gets in trouble for it. He is not on the show today.
Right. Well, he was off the show for 1 hour. ESPN hasn't commented. A source hasn't even told me what's happened yet. So we're awaiting word on that. Real quick, the thing that he was talking about with Jemele Hill, I believe we have this tweet. It's when she got fired for calling Donald Trump factually, thank you, a white supremacist. That is what he was talking about with, oh, well, what happened with Jemele? To Brett's point.
How was that controversial? I mean, the how right has she been proven?
You want to know why? You want to know why? I'll tell it to you. Because facts don't care about your feelings, John.
Okay. So I have no feelings about that because they don't matter in comparison to facts.
Exactly. I don't have feelings anymore.
But really fast, so on ESPN, when the Rapinoe stuff was going on or the Kaepernick over the past few years, do they avoid those topics?
No.
Do they talk about it in a very careful way? Are they allowed to express opinions?
Well, I think what's happened here is different personalities are put up on a pedestal. So, for example, Stephen A. Smith can say whatever he wants. Okay. Like, there has been troubling comments that he's made in the past, and maybe he got suspended for like 5 days or a week for that because I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole here. But basically, it was like with Ray Rice. But basically, essentially, depending on how, depending on your grandstanding, I'd say within the company, you can get away with certain things and other people cannot. To Brett's point, real quick, Deadspin spoke with one current ESPN talent who spoke to Deadspin on the condition of anonymity, who said this, the politics and sports thing. This is what it sounds like when a scared network takes the people of color in its audience and in its offices for granted. Couldn't have put it better. Wow. It is hypocritical to a T. Dan Levitard should be able to do this because he knows this experience and his dad knows this experience way more than someone like Bob Iger, a white guy, or Jimmy Pitaro, a white guy, ever have in their lives. He is hitting the nail on the head when it comes to race. There are huge problems in this country. And what I loved about this the most is that not only was it so passionate, but also when he brings up, thank you, when he brings up Colin Kaepernick, it is a direct shot at someone like Jimmy Pitaro, who has said, we only care about our relationship with the NFL. So obviously they're going to pander to who? The executives in Manhattan who work for the NFL.
Yeah. And it is reported by the Hollywood Reporter that today the staff was reminded by the higher ups at ESPN that they are to avoid, quote, pure politics.
Yeah.
Which is exactly, I mean, it is ridiculous. The guy also talks, he has a 3 hour show. What is it every day? 3 hours? 2 hours?
Wow. One local hour and then I think three on ESPN, so four a day.
So he has 4 hours a show a day, which makes you look like you don't apply yourself. which you don't. And
I can't argue against that. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time, but thank you once again for joining us. Always good to have you here, and Brett as well, and helping out behind the scenes. We appreciate everybody watch. Happy Half Hour, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.